recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Hey everybody, welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo, and as always, you're here to hear about true crime in Indiana. Last episode, we kind of did a bonus episode where I interviewed one of my friends from Italy as they were going through the coronavirus. He was in quarantine, we were not. Fast forward 2 weeks later, here we are. Now we're in quarantine, and he is still in quarantine. It sounds like Italy has gotten really, really bad. Overall, I'm recording this on April 5th, 2020, 4/5/2020, and just want to put our hearts out to the community and everybody who's serving, like hospital workers, police officers, firefighters who are putting themselves right in this pandemic's eye, right in harm's way. And I hope we pray that everybody is safe during that time, and I pray that your family's doing okay. If you're listening to this, I hope you haven't been connected to anybody who's died. I know a few friends of mine whose parents have been infected, and I've also known a couple people who've been infected, and it's just something we need to pay attention to. And also, to that matter, make sure you're paying attention to what's going on around the coronavirus. I'm talking about politics, what bills are being passed in Congress and in the Senate. What the White House is signing. Do a little research, figure out for yourself, and that way you can kind of keep up on the stuff that maybe the news isn't covering. You know, you can go to government website, you can go to the White House and just look up the latest bill. It just gives you a better idea about where this country is going. But my lesson here is research, folks. And research is one of the main topics of this week's episode. It's called Infamous Indie. No. You can see, guys, I'm a little rusty here, being stuck in the house, again, you know, not getting out, working on my words, working on my sentences. But overall, research is one of the key things I talk about in this episode, because we talk to author Andrew Stoner. He lives in Sacramento, California. He's a Hoosier, but not only that, he's written multiple books on Indiana true crime. And I haven't interviewed him yet? Are you kidding? No, actually, he's written one of my favorite books of all time, Notorious 92. Not only does it have the Infamous Indie kind of phonetics with the double I, but Notorious 92, the most infamous murder from each of Indiana's 92 counties. I mean, it's one of my favorite reads, and he goes over each county, so I love looking at my county, looking at the surrounding counties, what stories he talks about. He's gotten a multiple editions of this, so go to your local bookstore, order it from Amazon, go wherever you can to get the Notorious 92. Thanks, everybody, for joining me this week. I hope you enjoy this episode. I hope you enjoy the interview. We go over kind of some of his major cases that he really likes, and then also I ask him about research, about why it's important to do your research when you have an obligation, when you're putting information out into the universe, why having the correct information is so important. Something I really care about here on Infamous Indie. Thank you all again for listening, especially during this global pandemic. If you want to leave me a voicemail, I'd love to hear from you. I want to hear what you're going through, what's going on in your world, what's going on in your neighborhood. It's important that we document all this. And the way to do that is you can leave me a voicemail, 317-426-9008. That's my number. You can call me, leave me a voicemail. I won't pick up, it won't ring, but it's a Google Voice, so you can leave a message. Just tell me some of the basic stuff that's going on, what you find is surprising. Are you scared? Are you nervous about what's going on in the pandemic? But it's our job, as you'll hear from Andrew Stoner, why we do research and why we document these things in as they're going through history. So enjoy the episode, enjoy the interview, and I'll see you after. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the interview portion of the Infamous Indie Podcast. And on the other line with me, standing by right now, is a guy from Sacramento, California, a Hoosier native, someone who's moved out there a while ago and has created some of the best Infamous books you could ever ask for on the state of Indiana. Andrew Stoner, author, and now my new friend. I'm so happy that you could join me today. Thanks so much. We're going to go over all the books that you've written, but you love true crime in Indiana probably way more than I do.
Oh, yeah. Well, it comes naturally. I grew up the son of a firefighter and the brother of a police officer, so having a scanner in the house was normal.
You were not only a former reporter of the South Bend Tribune, but you were also a civilian public information officer, which is super interesting for Indianapolis Police Department. You're an author of nearly a dozen nonfiction works, including the Notorious 92, one of my favorite books, Infamous Murders in the End, in each Indiana's 92 counties. Also, Wicked Indianapolis, Cobra Killer, which was made into a motion picture, Andrew. That's crazy. What's Cobra Killer? Or King Cobra. King Cobra, sorry.
Yeah, that James Franco bought the rights to that book and created a film. It's about rival porn producers who one of them decides to kill the other one in order to steal some of their porn performers away. And through life, case from stretches from Pennsylvania to Virginia to California, was made into a movie with Christian Slater and Molly Ringwald, Alicia Silverstone, and James Franco called King Cobra.
I've never seen it, but I'm a huge movie buff, so here we go. I might have one on my list now. So, Mr. Stoner, you also have two new books out. What are they going to be called?
Well, the one coming out May 1st is Courthouse Chaos, and this is a book that is beyond Indiana. It covers the whole series of books we're going to do. We're hopefully going to do three parts on crimes committed actually in courthouses in the United States, and that is because the courthouse is kind of the, you know, citadel of justice. It's where we go to, you know, pay our taxes, cast our votes, and resolve, you know, criminal and civil matters. But it's also the place where a lot of crimes have occurred, including lynchings and bombings and people bringing guns to court and even, you know, killing the judge or holding the judge hostage, and just a myriad of cases where dramatic crimes have occurred inside courthouses. And if you've gone to one recently, you know, of course, they have metal detectors because it's become a very emotional place where sometimes crime itself plays out. And so the first book is about lynchings and infamous trials that have occurred in courthouses, including the Manson trial and others like that. And, of course, the one case from Indiana will be one of the last lynchings in the United States in the North, which was the one at the Grant County Courthouse in Marion in 1930.
Wow, Grant County has one of the last lynchings in history?
One of the last northern ones.
Gotcha.
One of the really last ones is probably in Mississippi in 1957, but Marion had three men lynched in 1930. One of them got away, but two men died hanging from a tree in the courthouse lawn in downtown Marion.
Oh man, that's crazy. I mean, where do you get the research for that? Where did you get the inspiration, I should say? Let's start there.
Well, as a reporter, I covered a lot of we used to call it the blood and guts beat. I covered a lot of police and fire, and that was naturally an interest of mine. My uncle was the police chief of the city of Goshen for 12 years. My dad was the fire chief for 8 years. My brother was a Mishawaka police officer for 30 years. So I've been around cops my whole life, and so it's always been something. I know a lot of people who are repelled by crime. I find it interesting, not in an entertaining sense, but in a sense of just fascinating what measures people will go to respond to what's happening in their lives. When I worked in Indianapolis, they had previously had a sworn officer be the PIO, and the new mayor and the new police chief wanted to reduce the number of police officers in headquarters and put more cops on the street. So one of the jobs turned into a civilian job was the public information function. And so I did that from 1989 to 92 and saw, you know, just dozens of murders, obviously. And was involved with the Mike Tyson arrest in that period also. That's probably our biggest case that happened. And there were, of course, in that era, a lot of controversial police action shootings or police-involved shootings, which created a lot of tension in the city.
And once again, what years were those?
I was with IPD from 1989 to 92.
Interesting. Yeah, we've spoken. Another episode coming out shortly is my interview with a 911 operator. She began her career with IMPD and Marion County, obviously combined now. I started out with IMPD when it was one of the first civilians to be allowed to become a 911 operator, probably for similar initiatives that were around 1989, 1992. So.
Right. There's always been a lot of pressure to have a strong presence of sworn officers on the street, but there's also an inclination for officers who want to move up, and that means headquarters jobs, and so that push and pull, that tension is there always.
Interesting. And so that's one of your new books, the Crazy Court Trials, or another way you're – say that it's
– the title is Courthouse Chaos. It's available now for pre-order. It's through a publisher there in Indianapolis, Blue River Publishing there in Indianapolis. And then the second one coming from the History Press, Arcadia Publishing, will be Infamous Hoosier Fugitives. Everybody knows John Dillinger as
who?
Our famous.
Who's that guy?
Our most famous fugitive, but we've also produced some incredible fugitives from across the years. So that book covers about 1920 through 1990, and it looks at a variety of incredible fugitives, including the very first one ever caught by America's Most Wanted was an Indiana fugitive. and also Unsolved Mysteries found one of their first cases was an Indiana fugitive, and then also a really sad case of a 17-year-old boy from Lafayette who killed a police officer in Nevada and was executed at the age of 17 by the state of Nevada while a fugitive from Indiana.
That's interesting, for sure. These cases, you know, how much research for these new books, and we'll get into your other book too, because we're going to go over, I think my listeners would enjoy maybe a highlight reel of Notorious 92 as one of your first books that I've read in full, which I'm going to get the new one for sure, because as soon as quarantine's over, I'll have probably 17 books read at that time, so might as well start ordering them up and having them send over. But yeah, I think my listeners would enjoy kind of a highlight reel in Notorious 92. But when I kind of wanted to ask you a couple of questions when it comes to your research and when it comes to understanding, you know, what is a qualified source or something that is, you know, can be used, and it's not like Wikipedia. You know, I think people maybe need to know a little bit about those basics about what you practice when it comes to doing your research. Where was your head at for doing research for the court cases and these new books? Like, how do you do research, in your opinion?
Well, as a former journalist, I will tell you that I begin really with the journalist's account. They're often referred to as the first draft of history. I'm very interested in the intersection of events with mass media. So I have spent, you know, hundreds of hours with microfilm, and thankfully a lot of newspapers, for example, are digitized across the United States. One of the big shortfalls we have is television news archives are not readily available, and that's a huge resource that we now have 50, 60 years of television news that we need to get access to. It's hard. Vanderbilt University has a very extensive network archive, but local news affiliate coverage is being lost to the ages. But I'm a big believer in secondary, that's viewed as a secondary source. I have not, because I deal with very old cases, interviewing people is rather difficult, but any kind of books, diaries, or letters, any kind of accounts, court records are obviously helpful. It's become a little more of a challenge since I don't live in Indiana anymore to do the research. So you'll note that I've really kind of gone toward my interest in mass media and journalism, and a lot of it will be how did the media cover the case also. And I think that helps reflect or helps demonstrate the seriousness or the, you know, what case should go in and what case should be left out. You know, and I have to tell you, I have tons of cases I've looked at and don't ever get to do anything with because they're interesting, but, you know, there maybe there's a lack of sources or it doesn't meet, you know, criteria in terms of didn't seem to gather the attention that it might have otherwise.
Sure, sure. Maybe sometimes they are interesting, like the ones that you're publishing, but not necessarily all the research is there to prove it. Is that correct?
Right. Like, I think I sent you also not too long ago a story about a guy who went into a church front, a storefront church there on Illinois Street in Indianapolis back in the 70s, and for an unknown reason just went in there and started firing and killed several people. And that, you know, was really a bizarre case that just shocked everyone. And now we have mass shootings and we think, well, not such a big deal, but at the time it was a really amazing case of violence in a place where you never would expect it. And it was Sunday morning church service, and it was right near 21st Illinois. And that's one I've looked at a lot but haven't done anything with, for example, because you know, it's still trying to find how to make that relevant, and other than just retelling what happened.
Well, 21st in Illinois is near Wish TV Studios. I think literally Wish TV is right across from there. You know, that's really interesting. And, you know, when it comes to research and making sure that you're reading the sources, part of it for me, if you're reading old newspaper reports or media coverage, you know, you have to take into account some of the biases that journalists might have. It's more prominent now, but I would say back then, even just the slightest way somebody would write something or would tell a story, you know, you could read into that. Do you feel like you knew all the journalists back here in Indianapolis covering all these big cases? Like, after doing your research, do you feel closer to them?
Yeah, I think your point about bias certainly shows through. Most reporters are pro-cop. They've cultivated strong relationships with the police, rode along with the police. I mean, when I was the Indianapolis Police Department, the reporters had offices in headquarters in the first floor. They had little press shacks on the first floor where they filed their stories. So, and when I was a reporter, I was often encouraged to go hang out at the cop shop, you know, get to know the police. And, you know, while they have a sometimes conflicted relationship, cops and reporters also have a symbiotic relationship. They're very reliant upon each other. And so the thing of it is that until we get to trial, frequently we don't get to hear what the defendant's side of the story is. And sometimes, more times than not, there's no defense, really. I would say I'm probably more of a law and order type than I am a bleeding heart in terms of issues of crime. Some people, you know, get the punishments they deserve. I confess I don't worry about some people after the terrible things they do being put in prison. I think some of them belong there, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe that's a little left over from your PIO duties.
I think so. But I think my values come through there. I mean, I would say I think everybody deserves a chance to have their say, and so as a journalist, I feel obligated to at least say what somebody might give as a reason for why they acted the way they did. But in some cases, it's just inexplicable. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've covered those kind of cases here in on Infamous Indy from Indianapolis. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Plus, I'm a former reporter myself. So, you know, being in court and hearing what some of these people have done, it just doesn't really make sense. And, you know, sometimes I'm a little law and order as well, even though there's always a story to be told on both sides. And, you know, that kind of brings me to my next point. You know, when you look at or listen to books like yours or listen to podcasts like mine, why is it important to understand where that research is coming from? When you write a book, why is it important to make sure that you know that you have the best sources possible and you're doing the most amount of information for the reader?
Well, I think that to show due diligence that you're actually getting into, for example, I always check corrections columns in newspapers to see was there a correction run for any story that I'm looking at Was there a fact corrected that was reported wrong previously? But attribution is huge, and I teach this with my students too, is that you have to attribute sources. It's all right to go to key sources and find what they've already found, but they deserve the credit for that always, and that's a big thing for me. And so if you read my books, you'll see I note a lot of the names of the reporters and the newspapers that covered the stories, because I think it's important that we make sure we understand that, you know, this isn't me standing there seeing this in 1950. I wasn't even alive then. You know, it's a matter of giving credit where credit's due. And I think that, you know, you can do that. Attribution is a simple thing to me. And I'm doing this with another publisher on another project right now. We're working on word counts to make sure, you know, they have some very strict rules on how much original sources are quoted, and, you know, working very diligently to make sure we don't overstep that, you know, that we're sampling appropriately and but not stealing or completely appropriating somebody else's work.
Yeah, and sometimes here on my end, when it comes to, you know, television reporting is journalism now, and using sources, it's very, very clear that you need to rewrite your own get your own facts, or at least rewrite it and give some credit. And in podcasting, there's no rules. It is completely open. It is like the Wild Wild West over here. If you see it on the internet, you can put a microphone to your face and just say anything. So I guess a lesson to my listeners, that do your own research, figure out where your podcaster is getting that information, because it is important for society. You know, journalism is a noble cause, and despite what people think about fake news right now, I still think local news is the heart of America. I mean, this is the people who cover those stories are the people that live in this community who will be affected by what's happening in that community no matter what. So, you know, Andrew, I think you're doing a service for all of us to be able to teach that to your students, but also talk about it here, how important doing proper research is.
Right, and if I could just add, I also like the fact that we wait and write about stories that have had time to settle, that are all the issues are resolved. I had a publisher not too long ago say they don't want cases. For example, with the future story, they cut it off at 1990 on purpose because they want more time to pass. They want more resolution to occur and more perspective to be gained, and that's what history allows us to do, is we gain perspective over time. How do we really feel about this? What do we think about this now? You know, and do we feel the same way we did about it at the time it occurred? So I think there's value in that also.
Yeah, giving it time to breathe. That's a great point. I really appreciate that. It's really difficult for me because this podcast, you know, I want to do earlier or closer to present time stories, because I'm able to get those interviews. So maybe what I'll do is I'll archive everything and just give it to you in 20 years, okay? And then you just write about it.
Well, I think the work you're doing is in some ways harder than what I'm talking about, because getting people to talk about things that are so fresh, you probably run into this, some people so very excited and willing to talk, and other people who are more than happy to slam a door in your face and really want to curse you off their phone line or off their front steps.
Well, I'd say if I wasn't in Indiana, I'd probably see that percentage rise. But because everybody's a Hoosier, they're super nice and will at least respond to me and say, you know, I'm not really comfortable with that, but thank you. So I guess I'm blessed in the fact of that Indiana specifically, people are more open to talk about stuff. So for sure. So Andrew, thanks. Let's chat about some of the top five different cases from Notorious 92. We'll try to keep this so it's relatively quick, so we don't, but if it, like, the first one I want to talk about is Marion County. Obviously that's the one here in Indianapolis, and in Marion County, your book is in alphabetical order, so you can go, it's super easy, but you've also written a couple of different updates, so we'll talk about a case that you've updated since the release of the book, of the copy that I have. In Marion County specifically was the case of remind me now, because I can't find
Marjorie Jackson.
Marjorie Jackson, that's right.
Yeah. She lived on Spring Mill Road above the Fall Creek area, at a Broadway area, and she was the heir to the Standard grocery store chain Fortune, which Standard grocery stores, the middle part of the century, were everywhere across the Midwest and Indiana.
And
she was the last of the Jackson family that really had gained all that money, but had, in her declining years, had grown very suspicious of bankers, one in part because she had some money embezzled from her by a local banker, but also some onset of some low-level senility caused her to withdraw hundreds of thousands of dollars from the bank and hide it in her home. And a fact that apparently was not was more widely known than needed to be, because she eventually was subjected to a pretty brutal home invasion, robbery, and murder to take away. And the robbers left behind several hundred thousand dollars that they didn't find, but they did take from her quite a bit of money, and killed her and set the house on fire.
Yeah, and you know, is that one of those cases that you talk about you know, being something that everybody's going to remember for a long time? Did you find that in the Indianapolis community?
Well, that one is one when I worked at the police department, everyone was still talking about, because the big joke was, you know, grocery carts full of actual cash. And there is a photograph showing a grocery cart with piles of cash in it. And the responding officers, you know, there was lots of jokes that the initial officers, you know, might have helped themselves to some of the money. There was nobody was ever charged with any such crime. And nobody has ever confirmed any of that occurred. But that was kind of the running gag, is the police and fire. The first ones there were well compensated, but that, of course, is just rumor and speculation. And
I don't know. You can't confirm that for us? Come on, Andrew.
I ran it down a little bit.
That sounds like you got your pockets greased a little.
No, I that's from the 1970s, way before my time. But she had money hidden in vacuum cleaners, behind picture frames. She had packages in the refrigerator of money wrapped in foil. She had Christmas and presents wrapped, addressed to Jesus, that were boxes full of money. The banks had tried to talk her out of withdrawing all this money, and she couldn't be dissuaded. And I've always thought her story would make an interesting movie.
Do you in any of the research, does anybody talk about her personality and what she was like?
Very much a recluse, very distrustful, had trouble getting along with people. She had a caretaker for the lawn who she fought with often. The neighbors would complain because she didn't keep her property particularly well, and that was because she was frequently firing people she hired to take care of the lawn. And so just had, you know, soured as she'd gotten older.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, I mean, imagine having that much money. You can just store it around. I mean, I would be very, very nice to people. I would be very... be very worried at that point.
It was a pretty amateurish case of robbery, although one of the couple was two men and two women who were implicated in the case. One guy was pretty stupid, bought lots of fancy cars and you know, bought drinks for everybody and gloated about how much money he had after the fact. The other couple, though, fled all the way to Arizona and bought a trailer park and had buried a lot of the money in the desert, which some of the money was eventually recovered from the desert in Arizona that was taken from this murder robbery in Indianapolis.
Isn't that funny? It takes us everywhere, Indiana crime. Do you find that these cases like Marjorie Jackson or some of the other ones, that there's a connection to Indiana in crazy ways? Like, I'm always doing the research and finding one more level of Kevin Bacon kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think my antenna are up for that, of course, so I pay attention to that when I hear. But you know, that was always the thing about the amalgam of the Midwest, that people, you know, that Johnny Carson was from, I think, well, I would say Nebraska, and that Lawrence Welk was from South Dakota, and that Letterman was from Indiana. You know, that these are the Midwestern amalgam of culture and language and style is one that's comfortable to most Americans. That it's not surprising that people, a lot of things come out of our state, you know, that have impact nationally.
I'm always surprised.
That's just That's my time theory about it.
No, I agree. I agree with you completely. I've talked about that on here a lot, and the fact that you could connect, I mean, the fact that H.H. Holmes was connected to Indiana in some way, and in Irvington.
Oh, yeah.
And say again?
Charles Manson was in a boys' school in Indiana for a short time. You know, so Count Ludwig, Leswig, who tried to sell the Eiffel Tower for scrap metal way back in the early part of the 20th century, he got started as a swindler in Indianapolis and Crown Point. So, I mean, his career even stretches back.
Or where the you know, the ghetto area from the 1920s or maybe earlier, that like Babyface or someone came from in downtown Indianapolis. Just crazy connections that constantly blow my mind about how Indiana is connected to everybody. So no, I'm a full believer, and I also believe it's also good things too, and not just infamous stuff, but like there are athletes that all of a sudden they'll like be really up and coming, everybody will be talking to them, and they're like, oh yeah, and that guy's from Carmel, Indiana, and you're like, what? That's crazy, you know, like it's just always connected. So
right. I agree.
Can I ask you about the case that got you kind of into crime and into true crime research? We talked about it before we got on the recording, but Elkhart County.
Yeah, when I was growing up in Goshen, the case that everybody still talked about, at least that I heard a lot about, was Shirley Rock. And Shirley ended up setting a record for being one of the longest serving women in state prison for a sentence of murder. But back in the early 70s, she was a Sunday school teacher in New Paris, Indiana, and a young brider, but was unhappy in her marriage and wanted to get a divorce, but was very religious, did not believe in getting divorced. And so she decided to, on her lunch hours, to go to a drugstore and buy lots of rat poison, and accumulated rat poison over several weeks and months, and began feeding it to her husband in his food. And he, of course, got exceedingly ill, increasingly ill, until he finally died. And she was arrested as she was returning from taking her nieces and nephews to an ice capade show. She was a very unlikely murder suspect, but eventually admitted that she had poisoned her husband in order to be free of the marriage. And that case always shocked people. No one ever expected women are usually not expected to behave in such a way, but also religious women in small towns aren't thought of as having murderous desire on their heart and mind. But Shirley Rock, she did prove that to be wrong. And so that was kind of my rubric, my starting point. What's that case that everybody still talks about, still thinks about, or is still shaking their head about in the local community, and went from there?
Yeah, and that was only Elkhart County, but when you opened up and started looking into all the other 92 counties in Indiana, you started finding that there were cases that just didn't go away in each county, right?
I mean, there's always going to be domestic cases, people who get drunk and get in fights and hurt each other and kill each other. There's all kinds of cases like that, but you know, like in Wabash County, you have a family that basically assumes the identity of the family they killed. You know, you have cases that are just have elements to them that are just shocking. The one in Johnson County that is in the case of Ronald Schenebarger and his murder of his son by smothering him with saran wrap was just not only just hideous, and it was a national story, but also the nature of the motive of it. Schenebarger was resentful toward his wife for not having attended the funeral of his father, and so waited till Father's Day to kill this baby, this infant child. And it's just mind-boggling the kind of thought process that was going on there. And I presented on this book years ago down in Johnson County, and Schenebarger's wife came to the presentation and actually told me I got it right. So I was interested. I was nervous when she first stood up to speak. I thought, uh-oh, did I get it right? And she actually said that I did. And she wanted the story to be remembered because obviously this little child had no chance at life, and she wanted people to remember her son.
Heartbreaking. Is she still in contact with you today, or was?
She's not, but I have heard from the mother of a young lady named Kathy Combe in Santa Claus, Indiana. She was a teenage girl that went for a jog one Sunday afternoon in Santa Claus and was abducted by a local firefighter and raped and murdered and was missing for a long time. And that case went cold for about 20 years until DNA testing and other results allowed the police to go to Florida and confront this former Evansville firefighter with the evidence that they had against him. They unfortunately did not arrest him the first day they went to see him, and he ended up committing suicide by the time they were able to get back to him a couple days later. But her family has communicated with me that one service the book does is that they want their family to remember Kathy, but it's difficult to retell the story. So she said, I hand the book to people and say, here's Kathy's story. If you want to know what happened to her, here's. And so in a weird sense, that's good that it's a recorded record of what happened to her and the injustice that was committed against her.
Yeah, you are. You're doing a great service to that community and for that family. They should, you know, I love that. That's what I think I like most about your writing is the sense that you are trying to tell a story, right? It's not just facts written on a paper that kind of go into, you know, details on time. You might as well write a timeline then. But this has a little bit more heart and a little bit more background. Most all of your writings.
Right. And her story is one, you know, that is just one of those. It's like there's a home invasion case from Allen County where a family was set upon by some guy. And the reason he picked them was because he saw their lights on in their house. This is in the early 80s. He was the editor at the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. And, you know, all of us have that nightmarish idea that some random person sets upon us and makes us their victim. And it's frightening, but and it's, you know, that's part of the compelling part of the story. But also it's a warning for all of us to be wise and be aware of what's going on around us as much as we can.
Yeah, the Osborne family were the victims there, Daniel, Jane, and Benjamin. So just one of the first ones that was one of the first stories that I read. So it's super interesting. You know,
yeah, they survived that attack and moved out of state and, has had a good life despite having lost both her parents and her brother in this senseless murder in 1983.
In cases like Decatur County, you've said to me that you have to update sometimes, that these books, just because they're written, doesn't mean that they're set in stone, right? That each update you make sure to check up and make sure you're doing your research, and if there are any updates, you make sure to do that, correct?
That's right, and two of the cases that are in the book that had to be updated most recently were Decatur County in the case of Christine Bunch. She was a young woman accused of setting her trailer home on fire. The motive that the police and the prosecutors came up with at the time was that she no longer wanted to be a mother, and that she, her 3-year-old son, Anthony, that she set a fire in their trailer in order to kill him and get out of being a mother. Interestingly, she was pregnant at the time of the fire, and that case was built completely around evidence of arson investigations, and arson investigations are notoriously problematic because of the inexact science of arson investigation. And she was convicted of, it was a June 1995 fire, and she ended up serving until 2012 when she was released from prison, when the charges were dismissed against her after it was revealed that there had been some chicanery in regards to the arson investigation. And interestingly, she has taken up work with the Center for Wrongful Conviction in Chicago ever since, having served that many years in prison. And I was interested in her story from that perspective. I actually did hear from her that, you know, she always wanted me to know that she believed she was innocent, and that even though she served 17 years of her life behind bars. She was cleared of all charges, and in fairness, the book needs to say that. So the new chapter on Decatur County is all about how she was able to clear her name. There's another case from Floyd County, which is a state trooper, David Cam, who was convicted twice for the murder of his wife and two children, and was acquitted on a third trial in Boone County, and has never been recharged. And so that case obviously is one that has needed to be updated. There's his co-conspirator did go to prison, has remained in prison, a guy named Charles Bonet, but David Cam, a former state trooper, is free and has always maintained his innocence. And on a third trial was finally acquitted. And his story, of course, has been dealt with nationally on CBS. His 48 Hours has covered that extensively.
Yeah. And you know, the cases of people who are, still around, and you've been able to kind of follow them a little bit. Have they contacted you after the book, or like, has anybody contacted you other than the couple of examples you just gave?
There was one other, I've heard from a couple of other people who, are in prison, for example, and saying that, they didn't commit the crimes. And the case I decided to replace, for example, the case in Steuben County, which is the county up in the top right corner, top northeast corner of Indiana, because of that, because there were so many questions about what actually happened and who did what. And I went ahead and went back and found a case from the 1920s that involved gin and liquor runners from Michigan and Illinois who obviously were traveling through Steuben County in the 20s, and the sheriff who was implicated in several crimes and the murder that followed. And so I updated that case to an older case just because I was interested in getting out of the back and forth discussion about who did what in the other case. And so if you have an earlier edition of the book, you'll see a different case from Steuben County.
Interesting. I'm a huge couple. There's a couple of cases that have piqued my interest over the years, and that's partially why. And it is because of the archives from Wish TV. So, like, picking the cases that I want to cover, it just seems like you go through a similar process on like basically figuring out which ones you're interested in. For me, Herb Baumeister was. They've heard my listeners have heard me talk about this before. That's my case because I just. It was Wish TV archive footage that you can watch on YouTube that I've put on YouTube with permission from Wish TV to do so. But I have like 45,000 views on this YouTube channel because it's a story that Wish TV covered of Herb Baumeister taking a picture of a dead raccoon that was striped over that he claims he saw the road crew, the DOT crew, stripe it over. And so he was so appalled that he took a Polaroid, got pictures of it, and then got the news, a.k.a. Wish TV, to come to his killing grounds, essentially, in 1995, a year before he was ever found out. But basically stand on the end of his driveway and say, how dare these people do what they had to do. But when I found that footage, it was like, oh my gosh, what? I can't believe. You mean this house is, you can drive by it? You can walk by it on the Monon? Are you kidding me? That's the part of history that I just get geeked out about. You know what I mean, Andrew? It's just kind of like, it's the part that connects it all for me. So,
He truly was using that property to his advantage when they were investigating and they found the scattered remains of a couple dozen people, bones scattered, that he tried to burn bodies and get rid of the remains of his victims. And of course, he's also widely believed to be responsible for the I-70 killings where men were abducted from either gay bars or from the streets of Indianapolis and ended up strangled and almost always dumped in waterways, originally in Hamilton County and Hendricks County, but eventually over toward Drake and, or excuse me, Dark and County in Ohio, just across the line with Indiana beyond Richmond. And the investigation shows Baumeister did a lot of traveling between Indianapolis and Columbus, Ohio, in those days, and I think a lot of people believe the touch of his evil was much broader than even just the cases they could confirm right there with his home in Hamilton County.
Yeah, yeah, and you know the sad part is, you know, he was never caught. You know, the suicide note that was left behind led to nothing, you know. So have you ever heard the theory that he might have been connected with Larry Eiler and another professor that had been acquitted of charges of murder?
That was Professor David Little from Indiana State University, and I had not heard the connection between them. I know that Larry Eiler unto himself was a prolific serial killer from Terre Haute, and basically had a path of death from Terre Haute stretching north all the way to Chicago and through Newton and Jasper counties. And Dr. Little was implicated by Larry Eiler in one of the murders, but was acquitted of all charges. And Eiler, this was one of Eiler's last acts before he died in prison of AIDS-related causes. So the truth kind of forever remains just outside of our reach because so many of the key players are gone. The Baumeister case was controversial too because there was disagreement between Marion and Hamilton County authorities about when or if Baumeister should be detained, whether there was sufficient evidence to hold him. And that was why he was actually on the move and was eventually found dead in a Canadian province.
And for the sake here, I have on good authority that a Wish TV story aired in the morning before the FBI had released the information because the TV reporter had written a dummy script. And that dummy script got pulled over into the morning show, and our Dave Barris decided to read. Now, he didn't decide, but the producers and him read the story on air, and the FBI had called right after the news director to say, where did you get this information? Because it's right, but we haven't released it yet. So how did you know that? And it turned out that there's a part of one of my early episodes where Virgil Vandegrift, one of the private investigators for the families of the gay men who were missing, was able to confirm with his source, which we all now know is Tony. You know, Tony in the documents, but Tony was confirmed the fact that to Virgil that they were hanging out and a news story came on, and that's what spooked Herb Baumeister. So it could have fully been Wish TV for sure, from according to my sources, which is just insane to me. It's just crazy.
It's strange too, because the police went all the way up to Kosciuszko County near Warsaw to pick up Baumeister's son, return him to Indianapolis to his mother, but allowed Herb to go. And from there, you know, they track him through Michigan and then over into Canada, and where he killed himself, I believe, July 3rd or 4th. And, you know, the police had him in their presence in Kosciuszko County at their cottage on Lake Wawasee, but didn't take action.
And there again is Hamilton County didn't take action. If it was Marion County, they probably would have taken action.
And that points out that this whole issue of criminals being able to exploit the weaknesses of the law enforcement system is to their advantage sometimes. We certainly saw it in the Dillinger era, where police officers, you know, radios didn't exist, and sheriff's departments didn't chase people outside of their county line, and state police didn't often cooperate with federal authorities or other states, and so criminals have sometimes worked the system to their advantage.
That's great. Yeah. Is Dillinger one of your favorite cases to cover overall?
And I just did a little story for my friends back in Goshen about Harry Pierpont, who was one of Dillinger's primary co-conspirators. His family moved to Goshen at one time in the 1930s and were during the era of Dillinger, and were trying to get a roadside stand, a bar and restaurant started, and weren't having any luck with the locals. People up in that part of the state were very worried. He had, the Dillinger gang had ambushed the Warsaw and Auburn police departments and stole all their ammunition and guns. So there was a lot of nervousness. And one of the more deadly cases that they, the Dillinger gang pulled off was in South Bend, where a bank robbery was fatal for a police officer. And so I wrote a story about the Pierpont family and their struggles to get cooperation. They, of course, believe their son was completely innocent. He was executed by the state of Ohio for murdering the sheriff in Lima when they basically blasted John Dillinger out of the county jail there by killing the sheriff.
And they also stole his car, too, that same.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they repeated this act in Lake County later, of course, but Harry Pierpont is one of the players in that whole story that I found interesting. And it might have been, he's a little bit older than Dillinger by about 10 years, and they met in state prison and was probably one of his mentors.
Do you believe that Dillinger was a killer? Do you think he killed anybody for real?
I don't know. I think his gang is certainly responsible. I think he set up the circumstances under which people died and were injured and hurt. But I also know, you know, that there's question about was he actually the gunman. But, you know, as you know, the law is such that if you're present, you're as guilty as whoever pulled the trigger. So, created situations where a police officer in East Chicago and South Bend and in Ohio were killed and others were injured. There was a bank robbery in Indianapolis attributed to him on Massachusetts Avenue, and also in Greencastle, of course.
It's now on Massachusetts Avenue. I believe it's on, not Delaware, but it's all the way, it's where the Art Bank is. Literally, yes. You can go. It used to be a gallery that you can go in the back, and they had Dillinger paintings back there in the barred out where, because it used to be an actual bank. So they had the place where the safe was, and some place where there were some bars. So there, you know, you walk in there. I mean, that's the thing about Indiana and Indianapolis with its true crime. I mean, you can see. I mean, it's even like almost like a tourist spot to go and see where Dillinger robbed this old bank. So. I'm under the impression, Andrew, that, you know, because his family has come out and said, you know, they believe fully that, you know, Dillinger wasn't a killer, that he never killed anybody, and God forbid someone from, you know, Indiana was killing people, that he was just, you know, he was just robbing from the good, being Robin Hood, you know what I mean? But
I've heard that take, and I've heard suggestion, you know, during robberies that mortgage papers were seized and torn up and destroyed, and, you know, that by... in some attempt, you know, relieve farmers or others of debt they owed the banks, and in an era where people were very financially strapped. And I certainly think that's part of the lore. And if you look at the feeling of desperation lots of people felt in that era, where opportunity was very, very limited for a guy like him, it's not surprising that he turned to crime. I think also you have to look at the original sentencing judge down in Morgan County for the little robbery of the grocery store. You know, you rob a grocery store and you get sent to state prison for 7 to 10 years. That's quite a sentence for today. We would think that's an excessive sentence. You know, we would think, particularly for a juvenile who didn't have much of a prior record.
Yeah, well, it gave him the education he always wanted. When he came out, he was raring to go and went on that tear for a couple of years. You know, it's just, I love that stuff, and I think it's interesting that he's buried at, you know, Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis. You can go right up to the grave there. You can actually see it from the street if you have a good enough eye. You know, that's the kind of history that Indianapolis and the state has tied in, woven throughout our culture. And so it's just interesting to hear your perspective on what makes us tick and what Hoosiers love to hear about or interesting to hear about. You know, I'm kind of coming to the end here, Andrew. We kind of covered almost everything that I wanted to hit on, and I wanted to open up, you know, the podcast to you to give your opinion about, just what you think in general true crime is as a genre and, you know, what, and then ultimately ended off for us here coming up.
Well, I have a theory about some of this, in terms of like why we like true crime. And it's interesting and you've probably experienced this, Joe.
All the time.
People who love true crime think what you're doing is very neat, think it's wonderful, interesting. But you probably have met also a couple other people who are very repelled by it and kind of give you that look of like, what's wrong with you?
I got to say, Andrew, it's a lot less than what it was, but more. I did run into someone who was ordering and I was talking about my podcast and she's like, oh, podcast? And she knew right away all the top players, and her friend looked at her and she goes, ugh, you're obsessed with this stuff. And I just sat there and laughed.
Well, I think there's a vicarious part of our personalities. I mean, it's like I liken it to the fact whenever I watch Hoarders, that TV show about people who hoard, I always turn it off and go clean out a closet or work on fixing up something that I've been neglecting because I think it's, you know, I don't want that to happen to me. I think we live vicariously through the experience of others, and human beings are fascinating. We enjoy watching and listening to each other. I mean, we still people watch. Right now we can't do it because of our pandemic concerns, but people watching has always been one of our favorite pastimes. And I'm just amazed. The thing I would say to you, Joe, is I'm amazed that people still engage in as much criminal activity as they do, given the resources that are stacked against them now with cameras everywhere, with DNA evidence, with the ability of trace evidence, with the sophistication of law enforcement. I'm very surprised that anybody engages in criminal activity more, at least planned criminal activity. I understand spontaneous activity, but when people think they can pull off a heist or something or some sort of crime, I almost want to laugh and think, have you been paying attention? Because we've really gotten rather good at corralling such things, I think. And although, interestingly, we've never wiped out the crime that the system is set to investigate and to pursue.
Yeah, you have to be a really smart guy to get around all this other stuff now, for sure. Yeah, it's like a superhero movie.
I more than once, from the days when I was at the police department till now, shake my head and think, what were they thinking? What were they possibly thinking?
They were thinking about the money. That's what they were thinking, Andrew.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's basic drives that are behind that. So some of these cases are understandable, but the ones that aren't understandable, I think, and the one we were talking about earlier with Baumeister and Eiler and some others, just that kind of lust for evil against other people is very difficult to get your head around.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I do run into those people that like it, and I do run into those people that don't, but more often there's better resources now, and that's why maybe the podcast platform for true crime has blown up so much as it has in the last 3 years. So I'm just glad to get to interview someone like yourself who's a pioneer in this genre. You know, as my one friend says, it's the lowbrow history. You know, it's not that highbrow stuff, you know, like civil war and war and positive things. No. This is the lowbrow stuff. So,
although, you know, you mentioned Crown Hill, Indianapolis has got President Harrison, James Whitcomb Riley, and John Dillinger in the same place.
You know, if that's not a representation of this state, I don't know what is. I honestly don't. That's a perfect representation. But, you know, I think what I'd like to end up here is just saying, you know, I appreciate what you do because of the fact that if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it, right? And if we have more resources, then we have more perspective and a bigger sample set to grab from so that we can learn and not make these mistakes and maybe get a chance to learn about human culture in general. And just, it's our responsibility as a society to learn as much as we can so that this stuff doesn't happen anymore. And so that's why I like to do what I do. That's what I believe you like to do. And that's why you like to do it, to kind of give us that perspective. So I really appreciate your efforts, Andrew.
Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate talking to you, and thanks to your listeners for their interest.
Of course. And again, tell us the two names of the new books coming out.
The one coming in May is Courthouse Chaos, and the other one is Infamous Indiana Fugitives, and that'll be later in the year. And those are both, ones through Blue River and ones through the History Press Arcadia Publishing.
Yeah, see, I think I like the name Infamous Indiana Fugitives. I don't know why. It has that ring to it, you know, that infamous indie. It has that ring.
It was, and it's based around, you're too young to remember, there was a song called Indiana Wants Me from the 1970s, and it's about a fugitive running from the law from having killed the guy. And I encourage you to look it up. I got a singer named Ardeen Taylor called Indiana Wants Me. Lord, I can't go back there. And that is woven through the book as well.
That's great. I'll play a clip before I leave, before we end this podcast. But Andrew, I always ask my guests to say, to just warn people to stay safe in their own way, whatever's going on in your life. You know, you could do it your way. But the way I end it is I say, I ask my guests to say goodbye and wish my listeners to stay safe, just in your way. So go ahead.
Oh, indeed. And we're living in an incredibly challenging, unusual time. And the biggest thing I would encourage people to do is to manage their fear, face their fears, but also do the things they know that will keep themselves and their loved ones safe, and trust the authorities that are trying to help us, and support those that are out there doing their jobs every day in pursuit of that.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Andrew. And thanks, everybody. Stay tuned here for the next part of the podcast. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And again, thanks for listening. As always, you can find me on Instagram, on my Facebook page, and of course, infamousindie.com. I got some bad news, folks. We had to cancel because of the coronavirus the live show, the Central State Studio show that we were going to do at the Vogue on April 18th. So stay tuned. There has been updates. It's been moved. Go to the Vogue's website if you want to buy tickets. It's later on in the year, so I apologize to anything, but as you know, everything has been canceled, so I don't feel too bad. We would possibly think about doing a live show on the internet. That could be a good idea, but we'll keep you posted. So go to my infamousindie.com page, the Infamous Indie Instagram page, and the Infamous Indie podcast page on Facebook. Please send me a message if you have anything, and stay safe, everybody, in the coronavirus. Listen to me, binge on some other podcasts, and stay tuned in the upcoming weeks. I'm truly thinking of y'all, and I hope the pandemic and you guys make it through. So with that, everybody, stay safe.